Okay, good afternoon, everybody, and salam alaikum to those Iranian non-American students who do exchange salam instead of say good morning or good afternoon. So welcome everybody, thank you very much for being here, and thanks to all the organizations and the departments, I do not remember the names, but I really appreciate their effort in order to extend their invitations to me to be here for the first time to visit such a learned institute and to become familiar with professors as well as students. I feel quite at home, not only because of the Iranian, but also because of the learning which is going on here, science, technology, philosophy, everything which is so dear to our heart. Now, my topic, as is has been announced, is secularism in the world of Islam, and this was the suggestion made by the organizers of this session. My analytical training, as well as Cartesian philosophy, tends me to divide in order to conquer, making some divisions and classifications in clarifying the issue, and then of course we can discuss it and follow it up in a much better and more logical way. About secularism, there are numerous books, a huge amount of books and articles have been written, especially after the re-emergence of religion in the world. You will see and you will face so many publications being made in this particular field, in politics, in social sciences, as well as in philosophy, because secularism has got, you know, the multi-dimensional issue which everybody can tackle it and handle it from his own peculiar perspective. So I personally am most interested in secularism from a philosophical point of view, although politics also may come in, because everybody, especially in Iran, every scholar, every intellectual is involved in politics, dilly-nilly, and therefore I have to also make some remarks about the political side of secularism. For those of you who are most interested in the issue and want to study from a purely scholarly point of view, I would recommend you to go to a very wonderful website called Immanent Frame. There you will see many scholars who discuss and write about secularism. They come up with very brilliant ideas, very brilliant issues, and you will find, for example, Chakranova, Charles Taylor, and many other such scholars who write and who you know, contribute to that site. So that is there is a lively, you know, field and source of information about the modern discussions and up-to-date, you know, studies of secularism. But of course, books are abound, and one need not, you know, mention any name, lest I should, you know, lose notice of some others. Now, in order to make the topic clearer, I will go through the divisions and categorizations that I have made myself to tackle each one of them one by one. I'm sorry, I have always this voice issue. This is not here, you know, everywhere that I discuss, and I know it is internal, it is not external, it is something to do with me, not with the, you know, the technology. I think we can, you know, see or perhaps look at secularism from different points of view. On the one hand, we have political secularism, which is the most familiar meaning, the most familiar meaning of secularism, political secularism, and then, of course, we have got theological secularism. And the third category is the social secularism, which I will come to that, and by that, I think we can have an overview of the whole issue of secularism in a more comprehensive way. What is political secularism? Political secularism system is best formulated by the very well-known formula that the separation of church and state. This is a very good formulation, but provided you do not generalize it to other kinds or other meanings of secularism, just exclusively retaining for the political secularism. It doesn't say the separation of religion and politics, it says the separation of church and state, which is a very apt formulation. Religion and politics did not separate, have not been separated from each other, and they are not separated from, they are not distinct. In any lively, any viable society, in the past and in the present, you will see an interplay between politics and religion. They give and take. And if you have got a religion which has got some values, some teachings for the life in this world as well as the next world, definitely you will, you know, it can contribute something to your politics. And a politically minded scholar or scientist cannot ignore, cannot overlook the religion, because it is a social installation. It is something which is already there in the society. And you as a good politician have to treat it in a right way in order to attract people, in order to get them, you know, to cooperate with the government. Look at Christianity. So many of the values of Christianity is now present in democracy. Actually, according to some of the political scientists, democracy owes a lot to Christianity, to all religions indeed, because of the dignity of human beings. You know, first principle of all democracy is dignity of human beings. And this dignity definitely comes from religion. It has one of the sources of the dignity of human beings is religion. Therefore, you as a political scientist, as a statesman, cannot ignore, cannot overlook religion by any means. But this is different from the formula that tells us that the church and the state should be separate from each other. That is altogether a different thing. This means it is a legal separation. The politics and religion, they have got factual, you know, cooperation and collaboration. Whereas among the church and the state, the theory of secularism says there should be a legal separation, not as to intervene or interfere with the other. And the state should run its affair without, you know, giving any preference to any particular religion. It has to have, you know, a unique view about everybody and every religion without having any preference for any one of them. Or perhaps drawing its laws and regulation and legislation from any particular religion. So this is the meaning of legal separation of religion and state. Now, since I am going to speak a little bit about the secularism in the Islamic world, here I should perhaps add that in the Islamic world, with more than 1 million you know, inhabitants and population, the separation of church and state, the separation of politics and religion is not there, as it is not there anywhere else. I mean, religion and the politics are so intermingled, so mixed, that you cannot even dream of the separation in totality. It is neither desirable nor possible. Nobody has ever tried, and I think now people are much more clear than before that such a separation is impossible and undesirable. But the scholars and the intellectuals actually are struggling in order to establish is a separation between church and state. But mind you, there is no church in Islam. Therefore, I mean, the similitude perhaps between, I mean, the similarity between Islam and Christianity is not in its place. In Christianity, you have got the church and you have got somebody who's on the top, whose authority actually prevails over all church and its command and its issues, its powers, is authoritative and everybody has to obey. But there is no such an authority in Islam. We have, of course, Shi'ism, grand ulama, but of course there are so many of them. There is not one single of the grand ulama. Now at the time, as we speak here and in the present time, there are perhaps 10 grand ulama in Iran. And these are official ulamas, and there are many other Qur'an ulamas who are not official, and they are there. Therefore, there is no single authority to tell you what Islam is, and what is the precept, what is the edict, what is the fatwa. So if you are the follower of Ayatollah A, you will follow him, and you will listen to him. And if you are a follower of the Ayatollah B, then you will follow Ayatollah B. And their fatwa and precepts might be sometimes different, even contradictory. But that is how it has been always, I mean, in the society, in the past and now. Once upon a time, there was no Grand Ayatollah at all in Shi'ism. It's only 200 years that we have Grand Ayatollah. No Grand Ayatollah was there, say, 200 years ago. There were always local Ayatollahs. You know, for example, in this city or in that city, in this village or that village, you had ulama, you had Ayatollahs, you had sources of, you know, fatwa, and you would go to them in order to ask what is your duties and what are the things that you have to observe from the religious point of view, what is licit, what is illicit, and so on and so forth. It was the fatwa of one of the grand ulamas, Ansari, about 200 years ago, who thought that perhaps we need one single person who is more knowledgeable, the most knowledgeable single person. He should be the Grand Ayatollah, and the rest should follow him and should come in with him. And that was the how we now have it nowadays in Iran. But before that, there was no such thing. In the Sunni world also, we do not have an authority. You have, of course, Al-Azhar in Egypt, you have got some other, you know, universities and madrasa in other countries. There is no single authority compared with Pope, for example, in the Vatican, or maybe for the Orthodox Church or for the Protestant Church. Every one of them has got their own Pope, let us say. But there is no such Pope in Islam. Every country has got its own source of fatwa, source of religious knowledge, and people do follow them. There is no church. After all, I would like to emphasize, there is no church comparable to the Church of Christianity. There is no grand mufti or grand pope in Islam. Therefore, the separation of church and state is not in its own place. Nevertheless, there is some meaning to the idea that religion and politics, or perhaps church and state, can cooperate with each other. And a state can be based on the rules and legislations of Sharia. This is exactly what it is now in Iran. And this in itself has got, again, two branches, two different types. Nobody would thought that perhaps after the invasion of America in Iraq and in Afghanistan, they would establish an Islamic state in these two countries. Now we have got an Islamic state. The church and the state, so to speak, are not any more separated from each other. Before the Saddam and under the Saddam, there was a secular state in Iraq. There was, and the state was not based on any Islamic legislation. But now, as you know, in the constitution of Iraq, you have got the explicit, you know, article saying that no legislation in the constitution, no legislation in the parliament should contradict any of the precepts of Islam. So this means somehow the cooperation and the closeness of state and church. The same you have it in Afghanistan. And of course in Iran it is much stronger than this. All, you know, parliamentary legislation should base themselves on Islamic legislation. This means an Islamic state, either in a negative sense, which you should not contradict any of Islamic precepts and regulations, or in a positive sense, that you should draw all your legislations from the Kitab, i.e. from the Quran and the tradition of the Prophet. You have the same in Kuwait, as far as I know. Even Egypt under Hosni Mubarak, not now, it was exactly the same. You know, they, according to the constitution, should not and could not contradict any precept, any legislation and regulation Islamic legislation. I can give you the story of one of my friends, late friends, Mr. Ahuzer. He was one of the Muslim intellectuals. He had some ideas about the revelation, about the sacred text, about the Quran, very similar to what I have. So he was condemned to apostasy and had to leave the country. And that was not by any religious tribunal. That was by the civil, you know, court who was you know, condemned, and he had to leave the country. And they even you know, ruled that his eye should be separated from him because of the apostasy. So this was under Mubarak. It was not after the toppling of Mubarak. Look, I mean, this let's say the penetration of the religious schools in the constitution of the country. I was fortunate in Iran. I did say the same thing, maybe even a stronger ones. But I mean, here and there, because there are different ayatollahs, and this is very important. There are a plurality of ayatollahs in Iran. And because of that, one or two of them actually condemned me to apostasy, but others opposed me. And, you know, that was how I could rescue myself and how I was saved. Otherwise, I mean, if there was, you know, a grand, one single grand, I thought I would have been not here anymore, and maybe was talking to angels in the world. So, this is, after all, just the situation. Therefore, I mean, the secularism, in the sense of, in the political secularism, in the sense of separation of church and the state, has not taken place anywhere in the Islamic world. And through the re-emergence of religion and the social role which religion now plays in the world, as well as in the Islamic world, and because of the interest that most of the youngsters show in the re-emergence and coming back of religion, I do not think that political secularism can happen, can take place in full sense of it in any Islamic state, in any Islamic land. Of course, I have to mention, I have to remind you that the dichotomy of secularism and religion is not a sharp dichotomy, as all dichotomies. There are always overlaps. I mean, you do not have a pure secularism anywhere. You do not have a pure religious state anywhere. There is always, you know, a mixture of both. Sometimes this is predominant and sometimes the other one is predominant. And that's why I'm saying that in most of Islamic countries, if not all of them, a full secularism is not in place still. And more or less everywhere you will face that the constitution explicitly or implicitly is placed on Islamic rules, or perhaps is committed not to contradict any Islamic rules and regulations and principles. Especially social values are very important, and all the politicians and the officials should observe them and should be mindful of them, lest they should offend the population, the people. So much for the political secularism. I don't think that declaring a political secularism would be beneficial for any Islamic state, and they have to bring in secularism, as I will come to that later on. And I mean, it would be very good for them just to be content, not to contradict Islamic rules, and to use Islam as a possible source of legislation, not a, you know, exclusive source of legislation. That would solve many problems, and that would not offend anybody, including and especially the ulama, the clerics, who are so keen and careful about the business of Sharia and the rules of faith. Now, coming to theological secularism, usually these two are mixed up, which is a very dangerous, you know, mixture. Most of the people who declare they are secular, they usually are not, I mean, do not carefully make a distinction between the two. So many people think that the secular person is a theologically secular person in the sense that he does not believe in God, he does not believe in transcendence, he does not believe in any religion, whereas it is not usually the case. Most of the people who are, I mean, politically secular, they are nevertheless spiritually committed to a particular religion. There is no contradiction between any of the two. I have encountered, I have seen many people who ask why America at the same time is a secular state, whereas there are so many, 70% of them are church-going. This is something which has to be, you know, solved, has to be clarified. It is a very, very simple matter. The state is secular, but people are not theologically secular. They are theologically committed to a particular religion, a particular set of spiritual values, and this is quite, quite valid. There is no contradiction between the two. So, some of Iranians who are theologically secular, some of non-Iranians who are theologically secular, they are responsible for such a dangerous mixing. They are responsible because they are preaching that in order to be politically secular, you have to be theologically secular. You have to abandon all religion. You have to abandon all spiritual values. This is a very, very, a fallacy, a big, big fallacy. And I am committed always when I talk about secularism to clarify this very simple point and to annul this very dangerous fallacy, to show and to demonstrate that there is a big gap between the two. Although all come under the rubric, under the topic of secularism, nevertheless the gap is huge between the two. On the one hand, you are secular. Political secularism is the attribute of the state. It's not attribute of any particular person. Whereas theological secularism is the attribute of person. It is not the attribute of the state. Therefore, the state of America, the American state, the British state, are politically secular. But people are free to be theologically secular, to be religious or to be non-religious, whoever, to be Muslim, to be Christian, to be, Buddhist, and so on and so forth. Therefore, now, this is clear enough. And then, of course, my judgment is that in most of the countries, if not all countries, Islamic lands, theological secularism has no place. I mean, there is, first of all, from the point of view of Islamic rules, even if you are a non-religious person, you cannot declare that, and you cannot announce it, at least in some countries. Either you will face, I mean, you will lose your head, if that is in Iran, for example, or perhaps you will, you know, lose your security and safety. If not by any legislation, then by people themselves. You know, you cannot leave out. You cannot, you know, announce publicly that you are against religion, that you are a non-religious person. You have to keep it to yourself. You have to have it among your friends and your, you know, circle, but not, you know, publicly. You cannot declare it. You cannot write a book saying, you know, publicly, you know, that you do not believe in Islam or any religion and so on and so forth. Therefore, theological secularism, in the sense of denying and rejecting all religions and spiritual values, or perhaps in the sense of converting from one religion to another. There is, I mean, I told you the story of Abu Zayd, who was condemned to apostasy and reversed. There are so many stories like this in Iran. For the people who became Christian, for the people who become Christian priests, you know, they actually risk, you know, and their life. Some of them actually lost their life because of that conversion. Of course, I mean, the sentence does not come under the topic of conversion. Usually they are accused of being the agents and spies of a foreign government or so on. But deep down, you know, the conversion is the real, you know, sin, the cardinal sin that they have committed. So, theological secularism, in the sense of you know, declaring that you are not a believer at all, this is not possible. And I tell you that it is not because of the law that you do not have non-believers. It is also because of the training. It is also because of the tradition. Usually in Islamic countries, you know, at least until now, there is not such a strong, such a powerful trend of disbelief. You know, there has not been any philosopher to write about this, to talk about this, and the anti religious literature is not, you know, widespread. And because of that, you would see that there are youngsters, especially among the youngsters, who are not all that, you know, good believers, but nevertheless, they do not want to say that they are disbelievers, decided disbelievers. So that is the situation about the theological secularism. Now, coming to social secularism. Social secularism is a different brand. It means the decline of religion. You know, this is the sociological definition of secularism. It doesn't mean separation of church and state, it doesn't mean theological secularism, as I explained, but it means the decline of religion in the society. That is something which one has to be very careful about. Nobody has got any, good statistics, any precise statistics about the people. I mean, a few years back, there was a poll in Iran, and you know, the statistics was published, but later on, it was the people who did it were badly punished for the government. That, unfortunately, shows that perhaps there is a social secularism in Iran, and there are youngsters who are no longer interested in religion. They are not converting to any other religion, but they are just, you know, turning their back to it. And that is due to the, you know, to the government and what it does. Because the government now is imposing its own views, its own, you know, ideas upon the youngsters. And because of that, this is a backlash of the government behavior. I don't have any statistics of any other Islamic countries, but my contemplations and my, you know, information tells me that you cannot, you know, and this is what I have put to some of scholars of secularism, such as Danova and others, that unless you well define what type of religiosity you mean, you cannot speak about social secularism. I mean, just the decline of religion in society is a blanket for it. It is something that you have to break it up, you know, break it down to some other thing. As far as I understand, there are at least three types of religiosity. Experiential religiosity, which means mystical religiosity, and then theological religiosity and experiential religiosity. I would say that at least in Iran, mystical religiosity is on right. But the experiential religiosity, i.e. the religiosity which is based on conception of hell and heaven and this and that, it is declining. Therefore, here also we need some divisions and some, you know, categorization in order to have a precise answer. But nevertheless, since there are not, you know, precise figures about this, I cannot say anything about it in particular. But nevertheless, my feeling tells me that at least the educated, among the educated, you will see, I mean, if you go out and have an interview with them, that they are no longer interested in the religiosity which is being preached by the government. And I think this is the case in some other Muslim countries. Coming to the final category, which is the philosophical secularism. Here I would like to present a little bit more and to tell you something about the what I call it the secular reason. In all secularism, the issue of secular reason is the most important thing. And you know, secular reasoning means because so far we were talking about religion and secularism, but I would like to introduce the concept of reasoning, secular reasoning versus religious reasoning. What is religious reasoning? Religious reasoning is to reason and to argue about something on the basis of religious principles. And that takes place between two people who have shared values and shared principles. Secular reasoning is a reasoning and argumentation which is based on non-religious principles and non-religious premises. This is clear enough. Now, there are philosophers, there are scholars who think that all thinking is secular, especially all criticism is secular. In order to criticize, you should not base yourself on any particular religion. You have to base yourself on your argument on general principles, which is belief, and which is participated by everybody in the society. And this is the meaning of the post-secular society by Habermas, as you know. Now, you see, this is a very important, you know, watershed. On the one hand, you have got religious reasoning and or religious reason, and on the other hand, you have got secular reason. What about the secular reason? Do you think that in religious societies, as in Iran, as in Saudi Arabia, as in Kuwait, as in Iraq, as in Afghanistan, all reasoning is religious? This is not the case at all. Therefore, secularism is penetrating, you know, and is, you know, creeping, if you like, in a clandestine way in the society through non-religious reasoning. And the carrier of non-religious reasoning in the first place is science. To the extent that a society imports science, it imports non-religious or secular reasoning. And to this extent, you might say that most of the Islamic societies, they now have learned secular reasoning based on science, based on modern philosophy, and so on and so forth. Because in all science, you do not employ any religious principle. You know, when you are in physics, in mathematics, in biology, whatever, all your arguments are based on non-religious principles. This is secularism. If you look at, for example, Turkey, in Iran, when I was in Turkey, I have been invited to Turkey many times, and it is a secular society in the sense that the state is secular, but the society is not secular at all. Some of the people there are even much more religious than people in Iran. You know, even the issue of veiling, of hijab, is much stronger, more powerful in Turkey than in Iran. But the state is secular, and this is again a fallacy which we should not commit. Now, in Turkey, I mean, the book which is written on philosophy here in America, this week, you will see the translation of the book next week in Turkey. They are so efficient in doing this, in importing the, you know, the secular philosophy, the secular reasoning, if you like. Most of, you know, when I went there, I saw that 8 of my books, of 20, 30, were already translated into Turkey. And, you know, some of other Iranian scholars and intellectuals, most of their books, and American, British, French philosophers, all of them will be fine. In Iran, I mean, one of the most important religious intellectuals of Pakistan, Hazrat Rahman, maybe some of you know him. He was in Chicago University for some time, and he produced a lot of books on intellectual Islam and so on. His books, none of his articles, I mean, let alone his books, have been translated into Persian, because Iranians perhaps do not like him, especially the clerics. But all his books are in Turkish now. So they're very efficient in importing, you know, such you know, literature into their language and introducing, you know, this way of thinking among their population. This is the case not only in Turkey, but also in Kuwait, as far as I know, and in some other countries, in Indonesia, for example. They do it very diligently and very efficiently, and they like it. And not only philosophy, but also science, which is the key concept and the key thing to the modern world, the secular world. So this is now working very well among the Muslim society. But I would like to add one important point to this. Secular reasoning has been always there in the Islamic culture. It is not a new thing. You know, secular philosophy, what you call it, Islamic philosophy. Let me clarify this point. This word Islamic philosophy is not our own. No Muslim philosopher has ever called his philosophy Islamic philosophy. This is a misnomer. This is something which has been introduced to us by Westerners. We have not fabricated the word. It is not our forge, nor our forgery. This is something that has been made here and has been imported, exported to Islamic societies. Islamic philosophy is not a word that we have ever used. Our philosophers, you know, usually call their philosophy as illumination philosophy, as peripatetic philosophy, and so on and so forth, as transcendental philosophy by Mullah Sadra and so on, al-Hikmat al-Muta'aliyah, but never an Islamic philosophy. That was not the word they used, and nor they believe in it, because their philosophy was a secular philosophy. It was not a religious philosophy. It was not an Islamic philosophy. It was not based on any Islamic principle. And this is not what I am saying here, it is explicitly in their own writing. It is explicitly on their own writing. Or the Sartre, for example, he himself says, theology is in defense of religion, but philosophy is neutral, is impartial, and it does not base itself, it does not take sides with any particular religion. This is what the greatest philosophers of Iran, Saduddin Shirazi, has got to say in his own book, his magnum opus, Al-Asfar al-Abra. And this is the case with any other philosophers and other philosophies. Therefore, philosophical reason has been always secular. I am not saying this in order to glorify, to glorify anything. I am just giving you the fact, because here there has been always a mistake and a misconception, especially among the non-Muslim people, who think that all philosophy is religious philosophy among the Muslims, whereas it is not the case. It is still a debate going on whether we can have an Islamic philosophy or not. And it was actually a question here as well among some Christian philosophers. Do we have a Christian philosophy or not? But I tell you and I assure you that at least among our own philosophers there has been no actually question of Islamic philosophy. Their philosophy has been always a secular one, based on secular reason. This is independent from any particular religion, independent. Now, what about ethics? Again, I mean, this is a common mistake that in religious societies or in religious culture, all ethics is based on religion. But that is not the case at all. You know, at least you know that there has been two different schools of theology in Islam. On the one hand, we have Ash'arites, and on the other hand, we have Mu'tazilites. One of the main, you know, points of difference among them was this. According to the Ash'arites, all morality is religious. You have to take it, you have to borrow it from the teachings of the prophets. It is a command of God which makes things good or bad. If it is prohibited, then it is morally bad. If it is not prohibited, then you are free to do it and to perform it. But according to Mu'tazilites, it is not the case. Morality is an independent field of religion. Of course religion can come to assist it, to aid it, and to support it. But it is not based on religion. you as a reasonable person and as a rational person, you are not obliged. It is not your duty, a rational duty, to borrow your ethics and morality from religion. Suffice you to be reasonable enough to discover moral and ethical principles. This is the school of Mustadrak. And the Shi'ism, which is the branch of Islam prevailing in Iran, is very close to Mustadrakism. According to all Muslim philosophers, Shi'i Muslim philosophers, ethical reason is also a secular reason. This is why I am saying and I am insisting that this dichotomy, this binary of secularism and religion is a very shaky one, is not a sharp one. On the one hand, and from one point of view, you may be secular, but from another point of view, you may not be secular. So, mixing all this together and, you know, ruling and issuing a single judgment is not wise. We have a secular philosophy, not only among, in our universities, but also in the seminary of Homs, where clerics teach. They teach Islamic philosophy, so-called Islamic philosophy, which is based on a secular reason. We teach, modern sciences in our university, which is a perfectly secular discipline. And through this, you might say that secular reason is there, but a secular government is not there. I am not sure whether there is a social secularism in the sense of a categorical decline of religion. And I am pretty sure that theological secularism has not yet taken place. This is my judgment so far, and I hope I am clear enough about what I have said so far. With one exception, and this will be my last point in this presentation, and that is the business of the social sciences. Now, I mentioned the modern sciences such as physics and mathematics and so on and so forth, which are secular based on secular reason and everywhere in universities and through, and it is the best and the most important carrier of secular reason in all universities. This I said so far, but with one exception, and that is the issue of humanity. Human science, social science. Recently, they have come under severe attack by the government in Iran. I mean, people are discussing and are debating the issue. Can we have Islamic social sciences? Can we de-secularize social sciences coming to us from the West? Or perhaps we have to accept them as they are. After all, they are sciences. And so this is a hot issue now. The same and a parallel one I do not want now in any other Islamic land. I mean, because in Iran, the politics are sort of interesting. A secular politics, does not lend itself to the interest of the government. They need a non-secular political science. They need a non-secular political science. And in order to meet that need, they have to generalize, the whole thing. And not only to de-secularize politics, but also to de-secularize all humanity, all human science. And now this is, a big cry in Iran now. The initiators of this cry are not universities, are not the ordinary people, are not the students and professors of universities, are the politicians. That cry comes down to us from the supreme leader, and he initiated it, and he has started the issue, and then there are some other clerics who are repeating and reiterating the same thing, and they are all shouting for a desecularized human science. I have written about this. I have taken part in the debate, though some of my writings has got, cannot be published anymore in Iran. But anyway, I have contributed something to this. I do not know really the fate of this. I can be, I am pretty sure that this will go nowhere. It gets nowhere. And because there is no alternative. I encourage them, please produce some of them. Do not discuss it. Do not condemn the secular social, so-called secular social science. Do not condemn them. Or even if you are condemning them, okay, produce something positive. Produce your own desecularized, your own desecularized history, desecularized social, sociology, psychology, and so on and so forth. And that will solve the problem. But all we know is there is no alternative, and they have not been able so far to produce any, you know, or viable alternative, and because of that, but this shows a problem, that from the point of view of the rulers of the society, this is of course a misguided and misconceived conception, but nevertheless it is there. They think for a society in order to be purely and perfectly religious, all sciences should become religious as well. Secular reason and secular reasoning should be abandoned, should be banned, and should be condemned. This is the regrettable conclusion that they have come to. And they are going to implement it, to apply it. I know that so much energy will be wasted in that way until they come to their senses and until they realize that perhaps it is not a highway that will lead us to the right destination. Fortunately, in no other Islamic lands you have such a thing, and I do not know of any society. Although I know something about Egypt, that there was such an issue among them, but fortunately there the government did not support any of any side. But in Iran we have the issue of desecularizing of social sciences. Now, I promise that was my last point, but another point I would like to make, and then you will be free not to listen to me anymore. And that is the issue of rights. This is what I have always said, and I would like to bring it to your attention here as well. I have got a dichotomy of, dichotomy that the rights and duties, but my view is that the pre-modern time was the time and the era of obligations and duties, whereas the modern time is the era of rights. But rights has got something to do with sexuality. Has got something to do with humanism. And if a society is not well prepared to accept and to support secularism, i.e. secular reason, then the concept of rights did not gain ground, you know. All religious states are based on the concept of duty and obligation. And all democratic states are based on the issue of the concept of rights. Right, and in order to have a full secular reason and a full secular morality, you have to introduce the idea of rights as well. Or at least you have to make a balance, strike a balance between rights and duties in order to have a well-balanced secularism in a religious society like Iran or any other country in the Islamic world. I think this brings me to the end of my presentation. Thank you for your tolerance, and I am waiting for your comments and or questions and observations. Thank you.
claim that political secularism doesn't require theological secularism. I don't know if that was exactly your term, but I think it's equivalent to what you said. And I agree with that. As a theological secularist myself in the West, it seems to me that the argument that theological secularists make isn't that political secularism requires theological secularism, but rather that a real political secularism must allow for a theological secularism in a way that you, I think, can claim political secularism in Islam doesn't.
Thank you. In a way that that theological secularism, political secularism in Islam doesn't allow for. Do you see the difference? I mean,
yes, yes. Can you comment? I mean, yes. I mean, you also, this is what you say, that there is no logical connection between the two. I mean, logically, political liberalism does not require, it does not entail theological. But as you say, it should allow for a theological secularist to announce and to declare that he is a Yes, that's true. But as I said, since in Iran or in any Islamic land, there is no pure political secularism, and then there is no permission, no allowance for a theological secularism to show and to declare that he is a This is the meaning of course of liberal democracy.
Your scholarly work in philosophy, so thank you. And my question is that I understand from your writing and from your talk today that you think separation of religion and state is not practical. My question is, do you think it's not practical because nowadays we have a huge population of religious people, so in other sense, because we don't have that social decline of religion, it's not practical in this sense, or it's not practical based on a rational reasoning that you don't, it's not desirable, you don't advise it at all. If you have enough atheists or non-religious people in the society, do you think it is desirable to have separation of religion, not church and state? Thank you.
Separation of religion and politics.
Yes.
It is not desirable. I mean, it's not possible, first of all, as you mentioned. It is not possible because, after all, there are so many of our population, a huge majority of the population, they are religious people and they are not willing to do that. But apart from that, it is not desirable. Because in a society, we all need each other. So, I mean, this I have said in my writing, you know, time and again, that religion is too important to be left to religious people alone. You know, it is too important to be left to them alone, to be left to love. They need people, they need others, you know, in order to look at religion from a different perspective, in order to bring in their criticism. You know, after all, religion, like any other social thing, you know, becomes so-called contaminated with non-religious things, with superstitions, with, you know, sometimes dangerous ideas, dangerous interpretations, and so on and so forth. So sometimes the religious people themselves can purify, can reform religion, and sometimes the ideas of reform come from without, come from outside. So both of us need each other. The non-religious people also need the religious ones in a society based on politics. It's not only a forced tolerance, it is a tolerance based on a dialogue, you know, and understanding. Because, after all, I mean, this is a big mistake. Sometimes we see in the writings of the non-religious people, especially some of the extremists, Iranians outside the country, they call religious people as stupid people, as people who are actual, people who do not have a modern reasoning, you know, and so on and so forth. This is so dangerous. This makes, you know, the gap between the two sides of the society so big and so huge that the reconciliation becomes virtually impossible. So we need each other in order to enter a dialogue, a viable dialogue, to you know, benefit from the presence of each other. Everybody has got his own, you know, capital, his own, you know, wealth, in order to bring in and to share with others, and we can together build a viable society. Otherwise, I mean, eradicating, removing, overlooking, ignoring, you know, the people who are not, you know, from our tribe. Is something which is absolutely unwise. This is what I say, that it is undesirable, you know, we need each other. And secularism is, as I said, it is not only something exclusively for the non-religious people, the religious people also use secularism. We have got a lot in common. You know, we use science, we learn science, we use philosophy, we learn philosophy. Secular side, as well as non-secular philosophy, non-secular. Therefore, among the religious and non-religious, there is not such an unbridgeable gap. You know, we have got a lot in common. Therefore, this is what I call it, and other Mosque calls it, a post-secular society. You know, in a post-secular society, we are not, you know, willing and we are not wishing the death of the other party. On the contrary, we invite, you know, the other party in order to join us, in order to come and to enter a dialogue and conversation with us, because we all need each other. We know that everybody has got a pleasure to share with others. You know, Marx once says that on the top of all criticism is criticizing religion. This is good. But apart from criticizing religion, we have got other jobs that, you know, as a non-religious person, you have got other jobs. You have to use religion. You have to benefit from religion. After all, I mean, the majority of the people in the world, in the past and in the present, are religious people. You cannot consider them as stupid people. No, they have got their own thoughts, their own ideas, and they are, you know, a source of inspiration, and they can contribute to the knowledge, to the well-being of society and the people. So this is why I say that separation of religion and politics. Politics is not for politicians. Politics is the well-being of society. It's the way you, live, the way I live. This is politics. Politics is not only in the cabinet of the government, it's everywhere in the society. And the man is a political animal. Political animal does not mean that we are politicians. We are political animals in the sense that all life is political, you know, polis, in the Greek sense of the word. Therefore we need, and religion is already there in the polis, in the society, and we are political animals, and we have to bring in whatever we have. After all, I mean, from another perspective, spirituality now, I mean, let us not bring in any particular religion. But the core of religion, which is spirituality, is not something that we can just, you know, turn our back to it and, you know, ignore it. It is a valuable thing. It is something, I think, one of the main and most precious discoveries of mankind. It's more precious than the discovery of electricity, of the discovery of atomism, and, computers and so on and so on. That is the basis of life.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity for the question. My question regards to the humanities and social sciences, especially in the Islamic world. You said towards the end of the lecture that if society is not prepared to import the secular thinking, then the issue of rights does not take hold. Especially in the context of the Islamic world and Islam as a religion itself, Do they really need the importation of secular ideas? Because Islam in its ideals itself teaches
the teaches to uphold the rights regardless of whatever the religion, whatever the race might be. And he has seen those ideals into action in the earliest of the Islamic history, especially in the history of caliphates, where the rights were upheld not because of the secular ideas, but because of the religious ideas. So can you please comment on that?
Yes. Well, I've got a lot of things to say about this. First of all, I think your view is based on a religious perspective or call it maximalism. Maximalism in the sense that you think that everything human, everything necessary for well-being of human life can be found in religion, i.e. Islam here. Perhaps I differ from you on this. I do not believe in a maximalist religion in the sense that it contains all what we need, all what is necessary for the human society, individual as well as social. That I do not think can be supported, neither by the teaching of religion or the teaching of the Prophet of Islam, nor by the sacred texts, i.e. Quran. I think, and I can support it by arguments, that religious arguments as well as non-religious arguments, that all religions, including Islam, are minimal in the sense that they have given us the minimum necessary things that we need, not the maximum, you know, things. So the rest we have to, we have to prepare for it, and we have to discover it. After all, reason is something which is there besides religion. Religion is not there in order to, for the reason to be isolated and to be obsolete. We have to use both of them. And you know, there is a saying by the Prophet of Islam that God has got two proofs or two goods according to him. One is internal, that is reason, human reason, and the other one is external, which is religion. Therefore, these two should go hand in hand, should go along with each other. Neither of them is in order to make the other one obsolete and useless. You see? Therefore, if we say that the secular reason has got a discovery, such as human rights and things like that, this does not contradict religion by any means. And perhaps it's augmented, it reinforces it, and perhaps it complemented, and give us something which perhaps for whatever reason we cannot find it in religion. Suppose philosophy, science, and many things are there which you cannot find with them in religion, but you can find them and discover them for your own human reason. This is the first thing. The second, this is an a priori reasoning. The a posteriori reasoning, i.e. a reason based on experience, based on scientific and historical argumentation. Look at the fiqh, at Sharia. Sharia actually, which is the set and the, you know, the system of religious Islamic regulations and values. There is a very limited, you know, space given to human rights. As far as I understand, and I think I know Sharia very well, the majority of the rules and regulations of Sharia are the duties of human beings, of obligation. The concept of rights is virtually absent. Or perhaps I should not say absent, it's very marginalized. You know, that the lofty part of Sharia, of fiqh, is about human obligation. Your obligation, you know, vis-à-vis God, your obligation to other human beings, other individuals, and so on. You as a father, you as a brother, you as a teacher, you have duties and obligations, which is very good. But rights talk is not a dominant discourse. You may look at, let me
T.O. Charles, who was the, you know, American Jewish philosopher. I said Jewish not only because he was Jewish, but because he knew the Old Testament very well. And his testimony is valuable here. He says in his book, Rights and History. There he says that the word right does not appear even for a single case, single time in the whole Old Testament. It is absolutely absent from the scene. The word right, the concept of right is not simply there. Now I tell you that in the whole Quran, it is not the case that you cannot find the concept of rights, but maybe two or three times you can find the rights as opposed and in contrast with obligation. Whereas obligation is everywhere. The book is imbued with the idea of the concept of obligations and duties and responsibilities, which is a good thing. But the rights are very much marginalized, okay? I have got the same, of course, if it is a protest or a complaint, I have got the same complaint against the modern culture. Obligations are marginalized, you know. Everywhere there is discourse of human rights, to the extent that people have forgotten their obligations. I tell you, I've got an experience myself. When I give public speeches in Iran and some other countries like that, I always bring in the issue, pounding on the issue of rights and rights and rights. Because I know that the rights are virtually possible and forgotten. But when I give some public talks in America, I always, you know, repeat the idea of obligation. Because I have seen youngsters here. They are all, you know, claiming people, claim their rights, and they forget about their obligation. They have got something to do and to give the society. But they always, you know, claim and demand and ask something for themselves. You know, it gives you sometimes a hubris. It gives you sometimes a false pride. Religion is there in order to give you humility and modesty and the feeling of being obliged, the feeling of having obligations and duties goes, you know, along with the idea of humility. And that is why rights are so marginalized in religion. It is our duty as human beings, as people who are, you know, bestowed the upon us, God has bestowed upon us the secular reason. We have to bring in and introduce the idea of rights in order to make a balance between the obligations and the rights. This is exactly what we need nowadays. And I think what all Islamic societies, be it secular or religious, because after all, secular reason is not contradictory to religious reason. Secular reason is something which is given to us by God as well. Never think that if we discover something by our secular reason, it is necessarily contradictory to religion. That is not usually the case. Most of the time they are complementary. Most of the time they are complementary. And we have to be thankful to God, not only because He has sent us prophets, but also because He has given us reason.
Thank you.
Okay. So
thanks for
the last question.
Thanks for your interesting talk. I have a question about the point that you made about the decline of religion, especially among youth and new generation in Iran, and the backlash of government policy. I was wondering if you can see the same decline in spirituality among new generation and youth, or is just this decline is just limited to practicing Sharia laws and this religious law.
In where you said?
Iran.
No, I mean the same thing you can see in
spirituality.
In US?
No. In Iran. This is declining religious, basically. Is this limited just to religious, basically practicing religion? Or you can see the same decline in that among youth in Iran in spirituality?
As I said, I mean, here I do not have really a clear judgment, and I do not want to overstep my information and to say something beyond my competence. Nobody, as far as I know, has got a very, precise figure, precise statistics about it. On the face of it, yes. I mean, especially if you go to university among the educated, you will see that perhaps there is a decline, especially in practicing religion. I can say that, for example, especially when you travel from one place to another, that is a very good indicator, by the way. You know, in the past, when you travel by plane inside Iran, or by bus, or by plane, from one city to another, usually in the middle of the day, the train or bus stop in order for the people to go for prayers. And you would see so many of them get up in the early morning in order to pray. But, recently when I was in Iran, traveling from one city to another, that was, as you say, in clear decline. I mean, seldom, especially in the plane, perhaps sometimes I saw myself, the only person who got up in order perhaps to pray. The rest were either, sleeping or what. In the train, in the bus, yes, this is a very good indicator. Also, when you go to mosques, most of the mosques are not, either they are not full, or perhaps most of the audience are among the aged. The youngest, there's a seldom go to mosques and so on. So this is not a good sign, of a good growth of the religion among the youngest. But my, observation is not a comprehensive one, because I have not been to smaller towns or to smaller villages to see what is the fate of religion of the youngsters in society. I can judge from my students in Iran who would come to me. I saw among them some who are really committed and some who were not committed. And so, as I said, the statistics is dubious. You cannot say among them. But on the other hand, of course, on the surface, of course, the society seems very religious because the ceremonies are always there, and the TV and radio, they are, preaching religion, and they are, they would like to persuade you that everybody is interested in religion, whereas, of course, it is not the case. But again, I remind you of the categorization of three types of religiosity. You see, for example, the mystics, the Sufis in Iran. No, it is on the rise. This is exactly because of the Sharia that is being imposed by the government, by the people. People usually go to Sufism, which they feel, think that they have got a more liberty in practicing religion and in doing their religious duties and obligations. So it has been always the case, and I think our society will be better off if the clerics do not tend or do not try to impose their particular view of religiosity. It is just one possible type of religiosity. There are other possible types of religiosity. And in a free society, we can enjoy all of them. And in that case, I think like Turkey, we might have a secular, semi-secular state together with a good and heartful religious society. That is the future that I envision for our society. Okay, thank you very much.